Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
The UN has cracked down, and Iran has snapped back. Will sanctions have any effect? This is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. After months of deadlock, the United Nations has agreed to impose limited sanctions on Iran for its refusal to stop its uranium enrichment program. In response, Iran's president insisted his nation is a nuclear country, triggering concern among his Arab neighbors. What happens next? What impact will the sanctions have? How do recent elections in Iran affect relations with the West? First, here's the news. I'm Sarah Terry, back with Which Way LA on KCRW. The United Nations Security Council has finally decided to impose sanctions on Iran for its refusal to suspend its uranium enrichment program. Iran's president, Ahmadinejad, said on Sunday that Iran is a nuclear country, whether the world likes it or not. Is the stage set for a showdown? Do the results of local elections in Iran mean that Ahmadinejad's power may be waning at home? How are other countries in the region responding to the situation? My first guest today is Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, Treacherous Triangle, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about the sanctions first. They are limited. They were not a broad sanction against trade that had originally been asked for. Instead, they are sanctions that will limit trade in material and technology that Iran could use to create a nuclear weapon. What effect do you think this will have?
Well, I think the sanctions themselves are not necessarily going to make much of a difference. The real game is not being played at the UN. The UN is more of something out there for the public to take a look at. The real game is that the United States, the Bush administration, is imposing unilateral financial sanctions and putting a lot of pressure on foreign banks to make sure that they are not dealing or trading with Iran.
This is separate from the United Nations, what the United Nations did over the
weekend.
This
is separate from the United Nations, exactly,
right.
Because the United States would never be able to get international approval for those type of sanctions. So much like in Iraq, it's going its own way and it's pursuing these financial sanctions, which really haven't been catching a lot of public attention lately. But those are the sanctions that, A, can be quite painful for the Iranians, and B, at the same time, the United States would be able to impose them without having to go through the United Nations and other international institutions.
How do those sanctions work, the ones that the United States has been embarking on?
Well, basically, the United States is putting a lot of pressure on other countries not to deal with Iran, putting a lot of pressure on foreign banks not to let Iran to use their banks to be able to make transactions in order to be able to sell oil, in order to be able to make other type of financial transactions. And that's obviously quite difficult for Iran to cope with, which is part of the reason why the Iranians have stopped to denote their exports and their budgets in dollar values and started to use the euro instead.
What about Ahmadinejad's response to what the United Nations did this weekend? He had a typical fiery response and claiming that Iran is a nuclear country and speaking up and speaking back. Were you surprised by anything he had to say?
No, I don't think there's anything particularly surprising, but anything has been happening lately. The Iranian pattern has been that whenever restrictions are put on it, whenever it feels that the international community or the United States is treating it unfairly, the response is to actually act even more defiantly and create even more problems. Whenever the United States has moved closer to the negotiating table or done things that are a little bit more conciliatory, the Iranians have reciprocated that as well. So that pattern seems to be holding right now. And what is very concerning about what's going on at the UN and what the United States is doing with the financial sanctions is that the window for diplomacy is closing, and we're going closer and closer into a lose-lose situation in which we're no longer really looking for solutions. Rather, the game is about who can endure the most pain.
In reference to the sort of decline or declining window of opportunity for diplomatic negotiations, the news over the weekend also reported that the U.S. and Britain are moving additional warships and strike aircraft into the region. Do you see that as a military threat to Iran or just the United States and Britain sort of asserting their presence?
No, I think it's a combination of both. Officials, Pentagon officials have said that this is meant as a signal to Iran. And this is where I think a lot of people may have misunderstood what is taking place right now, in the sense that there has been a feeling that the risk for a military confrontation between Iran and the United States, which was quite high earlier this year, a lot of people have thought that it has been reducing by the minute. Right now it seems to be increasing, because on the one hand, we're imposing the financial sanctions, we're going through the UN with other sanctions, we're putting more troops in the Persian Gulf, and at the same time, the United States seems to be toying with the idea of helping the Sunnis in Iraq to fight the Shiites that are backed by Iran, basically meaning that the United States would become a part of the civil war that is being played out there.
We're talking to Trita Parsi from the National Iranian American Council. We're going to be getting to this broader picture of what's happening in the region in the course of the show. Right now, I'd like to bring in another guest. Gal Luft is Executive Director of the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security, a Washington-based think tank. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Let's go back for a moment to this issue of the sanctions, both what the United Nations decided to pass this weekend and what the U.S. has been doing on its own. How would you analyze that situation?
Well, those sanctions, as you said, are mainly targeting the nuclear program. They're not aiming at the broader economic capabilities of Iran, so they're very limited in scope. There are a number of sanctions, economic sanctions, that are in place already. They have been in place since the U.S. introduced the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act of 1996, which basically authorizes mandatory sanctions against non-U.S. companies that invest more than $20 million a year in Iran's oil and natural gas industries. And there are, I think that Iran has already begun to feel the pinch of these sanctions. Just point out a study that just came out recently by the National Academy of Sciences, is talking about Iran suffering a staggering decline in revenue from oil exports, and that they have a difficult capability. They cannot even ramp up production of oil, which is the main source of their revenue. So there's a lot that is already going on that is not part of the UN framework, that, in my view, impacts the Iranian economy more than those sanctions that were introduced by the UN now.
That report you mentioned from the National Academy of Sciences indicate that Iran's oil revenues could disappear by 2015, and indicates that maybe there actually is a case to be made for the fact that what Iran wants is nuclear power, not just nuclear weapons. Do you buy that?
Well, you know, it's a chicken and egg argument, because one of the reasons that Iran's oil exports are in decline is because there's not enough investment. There's hardly any investment going on there. And if they modified their behavior, there would have been an influx of money going into the country. After all, the world is in great need for petroleum and natural gas. There's no lack of demand for it. And if they only changed their behavior, that problem could have been solved. But their insistence on going nuclear, which I believe is not for economic or for energy reasons, but for strategic reasons, if they insist on doing that, then it means that their main source of revenue will be impacted, and that could hurt them more than anything.
I'm curious, I'd like to ask both of the guests we've got on the air right now, Trita Parsi and Gal Luft, what do you think is going to be driving the way events unfold? The United Nations has not taken as strong of an action as some people had hoped. Does that undercut the United Nations' effectiveness? Is it, in fact, internal domestic policies in Iran? Or is it the Arab neighbors in the region who are concerned about Iran's agenda and what it's doing? And we're going to explore this in the show, but I'd like to just start that off first with Gal Luft. We've been talking to you. What is driving the unfolding of events right now?
Of course, all of the above will drive, I mean, the Iranian behavior, the leadership, the rhetoric coming out of Iran will be important. But I think that we should not ignore the sort of subtext that is unfolding before our eyes, and that is the growing tension between Shiites and Sunnis in Iraq and Lebanon and other places. We heard some statement coming from Egypt.
Egypt, in fact, said that Iran was more dangerous. Oh, no, it was an editor in Saudi Arabia said that Iran is more dangerous than Israel now.
That is exactly what is happening here. And I think that one of the reasons that we see now increased presence, military presence in the Gulf and Dick Cheney going to Riyadh for consultations and other things that are happening has to do with a great deal of nervousness coming from Saudi Arabia, which sees itself as the hegemon in the Sunni world, and they feel threatened by these developments, by the fact that Iraq has turned into a Shiite state, by the fact that Iran is emboldened, by the fact that Hezbollah in Lebanon is undermining the regime there. So all these things, I think, have to do with the subtext of deepening tension within the Muslim world. And that will have an impact on the choices that America and its European allies are making.
That's Gal Luft, Executive Director of the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security in Washington, D.C. I'd like to pose the same question to Trita Parsi from the National Iranian American Council. We've just been talking about the sort of the broad overview of the situation with the individual forces and players within it. What do you think is driving what's unfolding now in Iran and what will unfold in the future?
Let me just first comment on the idea that if Iran just changed its behavior, everything would be fine. I think it is somewhat of an inaccurate description of what reality has been for the last couple of years, because the Iranians sent a proposal in 2003 to the Bush administration in which they offered a tremendous amount of compromises, including on the nuclear issue, including on Israel, on Hezbollah, and the response from the Bush administration was a complete silence. This has convinced many people in Tehran that the United States is not really concerned about Iranian policies as much as it is concerned about Iranian power. And as a result, if they give compromises and that doesn't have any effect, then they might as well not give them to begin with. Regarding what is driving events in the region, I would agree that to some of the things that Gal pointed out to, but at the same time, even though the neoconservative experiment in Iraq has been an utter failure and the United States has lost a tremendous amount of leverage, it is still the most powerful country in the world, and it is still the country that through its decisions are driving most of the events over there. I think over the next couple of years we will see, or next couple of months at least, we'll see how central Iraq is in this equation, and how central it is if the United States chooses to continue to play a balance of power game, or if it wants to go for a more collective security arrangement for the region that involves all regional states. If it goes for the balance of power game and it starts to create alliances with the Sunnis, by the way, who are the ones who have been killing American soldiers, and the Saudis have been funding the Sunni insurgency in Iraq, and starts to create that type of an alliance to be able to balance Iran, then we will not see a resolution to what is taking place here for the foreseeable future. Rather, we will see a continuation of violence and instability in the region for decades to come.
Thank you, Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council. He's author of the forthcoming book, Treacherous Triangle, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States. We've got another guest to bring into the conversation now. Anne Barnard is the Middle East correspondent for the Boston Globe. She's been reporting from Iran recently, and she's actually in the United States on vacation at the moment. Thanks for taking time to join us.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I'd like to ask you a few questions about the mood on the streets, the mood among the students. There were recent local elections that were seen as a setback for Ahmadinejad. Just briefly, we hear all about the macro level of everything. Who said what at the international level? What's the mood on the streets among students and average people in Iran?
Well, the mood on the street in Iran is overwhelmingly focused on the economic domestic situation. Most Iranians don't care very much about Hezbollah or even about what's going on in Iraq, except to the extent that they don't like the idea that the United States came in and promised democracy and ended up with chaos. But it's not their primary concern. What they're concerned about is the Iranian economy. It's a very stressed economy, even though the oil prices are very high right now. There's high rate and growing rate of unemployment among the youth, and it's a very young country. So young people, those who have good education, those who have not been able to get an education, they're all worried about their future. And I think there was a lot of disappointment in Ahmadinejad, who was elected on populist promises to reform the economy, to get more of the oil wealth to the people directly. And he basically went around the country promising a lot of what we would call pork barrel projects for various cities and towns, some of which got done, many of which didn't. And many people who turned to him a year and a half ago in the elections are feeling disappointed now that they haven't seen improvements in their personal economic situation. So we saw a backlash in the election results.
We're talking with Anne Barnard, Middle East correspondent for the Boston Globe. Let's go back to this question of the mood among students in particular. There was a protest last week in which students burned pictures of the president and said, "Death to the dictator."
Yes, these kinds of things happen from time to time, and they involve a small number of people. But we have seen a rise in these kind of incidents over the past few months, and it goes back to the backlash I was referring to over President Ahmadinejad. Many students and young people were followers of the reformist movement that suffered a surprise defeat in the presidential elections against Ahmadinejad, who beat Rafsanjani, who was the candidate from the reformist wing. That was largely because the reformists had talked for a decade about ideas like freedom of speech and democratization of the Islamic Republic. And there had been strides in an increase in personal freedom and in what people could watch on TV, what they could read, what they could say, what they could wear. But it had not corresponded to the kind of economic improvements that many Iranians wanted.
Ahmadinejad was just elected last year. The next presidential elections aren't for a few more years. How does this play out on the ground? Do you think the students will become increasingly active? And the whole history of popular politics, of grassroots actions in Iran is quite well known.
Yeah, well, what I was going to say is that there was a certain amount of apathy among the more liberal voters that led to the election of Ahmadinejad. And in the years since he's been elected, you've seen many students and young people realizing that it was a big mistake not to go to the polls, to sort of sit out the election last time. And this time, they all went to the polls. Not everybody went to the polls, but a larger percentage than expected went to the polls in these elections for city council and for the Assembly of Experts, which is a clerical body that appoints the supreme leader, which is largely a body that most Iranians don't pay any attention to. But what these elections were seen as was a referendum on Ahmadinejad. The allies of Ahmadinejad largely did poorly, and the reformists did better than expected, because many of these students became frustrated. They were worried about a backlash against the increased freedoms that they enjoyed over the past decade. We've seen a crackdown on many websites that have been blocked by internet providers who are forced to block these sites, or else they'll be shut down by the government. You have students being put in jail. You have student activists who died in a hunger strike a few months ago. There have been reports that the practice of stoning women has reappeared in some provincial areas. So you really have a lot of young people concerned about a rollback of what gains in freedom were made during the reformist era. When you add that to disappointment with the economic situation, you have the potential for a lot more activism. And certainly Iranians are very outspoken. You'll find them much more willing to express dissenting opinions than, for instance, in Syria, a country that on the surface looks like there's more freedom of choice because people aren't forced to wear Islamic dress, for instance. But they're much more afraid there to speak their minds about the government. In Iran, you have actually quite vibrant dissent that's expressed on an individual level. The problem happens when anyone tries to organize, a virtual community, like online communities, have been blocked by the government because they're so worried about any organized opposition.
Okay, thanks so much for giving us a better view of what's happening on the ground in Iran. That was Anne Bernard, Middle East correspondent for the Boston Globe. Thanks for taking time from your vacation. Our next guest is Abbas Milani, director of the Iranian Studies Program at Stanford University. He's also a research fellow and co-director of the Iran Democracy Project at the Hoover Institution. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're just hearing from Anne Bernard about the backlash against Ahmadinejad just a year into his term as president. Are we seeing a realignment within Iran politically? Is he on his way out in terms of being in favor with the clerics who are the supreme rulers in Iran?
I don't know whether he's on his way out, but I think you're absolutely right that this might well be the beginning of a major realignment, because I don't think these elections were simply about student discontent or newfound student radicalism. I think the student radicalism is, in fact, the tip of the iceberg. What you have right now in Iran is massive disgruntlement with Mr. Ahmadinejad that begins from the ranks of the clergy, begins from the ranks of the people within the government, to people in the bazaars, for example, which are the most important, vibrant part of the Iranian economy. The bazaaris have become very disgruntled because the economy is in a virtual standstill. There is a massive flight of capital. There is no change in the unemployment status. The coming of this embargo is going to only add fuel to what was already a very serious economic crisis. So,
well, let me ask you, does Ahmadinejad get any political mileage out of standing up as sort of a tough guy to the United States, to the West, or to, you know, the sort of the Sunni majority Arab states around Iran? Does that play domestically?
I don't think it plays that well domestically, but it plays to the Arab streets where some of this is actually addressed to. In the streets of Tehran, although he gets some mileage out of the kind of populist promises that he's been making, I mean, he goes around, as Anne reported, throwing money at the poorer sections of the country. Some of it has actually materialized, so he does have some base of support amongst the disfranchised. But the middle classes that are being squeezed out, the upper classes that are being pressured, the private sector that is being completely almost shut out of the system, they are bringing forth an argument that says, in fact, Ahmadinejad's intransigence hasn't gotten us anything. It has gotten us more in trouble. That his policies, his rhetoric on the Holocaust, his talk on annihilation of Israel has isolated us. And you can see clearly people like Mr. Khatami, the ex-president, mm-hmm. Mr. Rafsanjani.
Both ex-presidents.
They're also ex-presidents.
Both, yes, progressive or moderate ex-presidents.
Absolutely, who are now more vocal in articulating this point.
Does that indicate that the clerics are becoming a bit disillusioned with Ahmadinejad? What's going on from the religious governance perspective within Iran?
I think there is a big split within the clerical establishment as well. Some of the clerics, most, for example, embodied in the person of Mr. Misbahi Yazdi, who is the guru, the spiritual guru to Mr. Ahmadinejad, they lost badly in this election because the majority of the other factions within the clergy who saw Misbahi Yazdi as out of touch with reality, who saw Ahmadinejad gaining too much power to the detriment of the clergy, decided to form an alliance against them. In a sense, the election was a grand alliance of forces, including those who were even close to Mr. Khamenei, who helped elect Ahmadinejad. I mean, everybody, I think, is now in agreement that Ahmadinejad was elected because Mr. Khamenei decided that he should help him get elected. Mr. Khamenei, too, has become disillusioned and, I think, frightened. Frightened in a sense that he knows Iran is now more isolated than it has ever been. And he knows that Ahmadinejad seems to be aggressively trying to increase his own power to the detriment of everybody else.
Okay, in the few minutes that we have remaining in the program, I'd like to go back to Gal Luft, Executive Director of the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security. Let's revisit again sort of the macro picture with briefly, if you can tell me, about the concerns within the region for nuclear proliferation, for what Iran's agenda is.
Look, the last meeting of the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Group, the six Sunni countries of the Persian Gulf, passed a resolution or agreed that they're going to start their own nuclear program, albeit for peaceful purposes, but it always starts with these kind of things. A few weeks before that, Hosni Mubarak made a speech, and he got a lot of applause for his statement that Egypt is going to start its own nuclear program for peaceful purposes. So I think that everybody in the Sunni world is very concerned about the nuclear program, but not only about the nuclear program, but about the whole idea of the rise of the Shia as the dominant power in the Muslim world. And I think that there's so many conflicting interests here, and the danger is that if Iran really succeeds with its nuclear program, the other Sunni countries will follow suit. In other words, it's almost a given that if there is a Shiite bomb, there will be an Arab-Sunni bomb several years later. And that means a very different, a very new Middle East, a Middle East in which the full-blown nuclearization of the region with many dangerous consequences. So I think that is the sort of underlying concern.
And we're going to have to wrap. Thank you for the underlying concern in the region. As you said, we're going to have to wrap up the show today at that point. Thanks so much to all of our guests for joining us. Trita Parsi is president of the National Iranian American Council. Anne Barnard is a correspondent with the Boston Globe. Abbas Milani is director of the Iranian Studies Program at Stanford University. And Gal Luft is executive director of the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Katie Cooper and Karen Radziner. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.